From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a film retrospective with D.A. Pennebaker. He's one of the founders of the documentary style known as cinema verite, or direct cinema, and his movies include Don't Look Back, about Bob Dylan's 1965 tour of England, and Monterey Pop, about the 1967 rock festival. Summer is the time when we all come together for festivals of all kinds, and commentator Maureen Corrigan tells us why she hates these festivals. Also today, Bad Taste with Paul Bartel. He writes, directs, and stars in his irreverent film comedies, including Eating Raoul and scenes from the class struggle in Beverly Hills. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. Oliver North drew a light sentence today for his part in the Iran-Contra scandal. NPR's Mara Liasson reports that Judge Gerhard Gezel gave North a 3-year suspended sentence and a $150,000 fine.
North, who was convicted of lying to Congress, destroying documents, and accepting a home security system from arms dealer Richard Secord, was also put on 2 years probation and barred from holding public office. In sentencing North, Gezel pointed out that the former national security aide had used his notoriety to become a rich man, earning $25,000 per speech. Now the judge told North, you have a choice. You can continue to inflame the myth that has supported you, or you can do something useful. Then Gezel ordered North to perform 1,200 hours of community service in a drug program in Washington, D.C. as part of his sentence. Judge Gezel said North still lacks full understanding of how his actions tarnished the public service, but that jail would only harden North's misconceptions. In Washington, I'm Mara Liasson.
Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev has joined France's President François Mitterrand in calling for an immediate ceasefire in Lebanon's civil war. The two leaders proclaimed their support for Arab League efforts to end 14 years of fighting and offered to help reach a settlement, notably, they said, within the framework of the United Nations Security Council. Gorbachev also chided President Bush today for suggesting that Moscow withdraw its troops from Poland. The Soviet leader said Bush is just trying to score propaganda points. Bush made the suggestion in an interview with Polish journalists published over the weekend. Former Soviet President and Foreign Minister Andrei Gromyko was laid to rest in Moscow today. Only one member of the Politburo attended the funeral, while President Gorbachev continued his official visit to France. The BBC's Diana Goodman reports.
Mr. Gromyko has been hailed as one of the Soviet Union's greatest ever statesmen, but his funeral was a curiously modest affair, even bearing in mind that he was a member of the old guard. He was buried not on the wall of the Kremlin, but in Moscow's Novodevichy Cemetery, and Moscow Radio said that decision had prompted what it called working people to send telegrams of protest to the Supreme Soviet. The report said the official explanation was that the place of burial had been chosen by Mr. Gromyko's family. But that does not explain why the Soviet Prime Minister and other leading figures failed to attend the funeral. And even those officials who were there to make speeches produced only the expected platitudes, which were delivered with no hint of emotion.
The BBC's Diana Goodman. Former Hungarian leader Janos Kadar is gravely ill. Party sources say he may die within 24 hours. The 77-year-old Communist Party leader led Hungary from 1956 to 1988. This is NPR News. In Abingdon, Virginia, a federal judge has levied more fines against the United Mine Workers Union for blocking Pittston coal traffic. Chris Roberts of member station WVTF in Roanoke has a report.
For the past few weeks, hundreds of miners in long, slow-moving convoys have been driving up and down coal roads in an effort to block Pittston coal shipments. Most of the miners ticketed for impeding traffic have been wildcat strikers from other states. Today, federal judge Glenn Williams fined the union and two of its officers $720,000 for violating his ban on the roadblocks. The fines are in addition to penalties imposed by Williams last month. Meanwhile, Virginia State Police say a dynamite explosion rocked a Pittston warehouse in McClure, Virginia today. The blast blew out several windows and may have caused structural damage, but no injuries were reported. Pittston Coal Group President Mike Odom believes striking miners were responsible for the explosion, but state police say no arrests have been made and the investigation is continuing. For National Public Radio, I'm Chris Roberts in Roanoke.
A judge in Columbus, Ohio, today delayed a decision on whether to send the gambling case against Pete Rose to a federal court. The delay is a temporary setback for the Cincinnati Reds manager in his legal battle against baseball commissioner Bart Giamatti. Earlier today, Rose's lawyers had asked the presiding judge in the case to send the case back to a local court in Cincinnati, which has already ruled once in Rose's favor. Mexico's ruling Institutional Revolutionary Party conceded defeat today in a governor's race. Party officials say the results of Sunday's elections in Baja State show the conservative National Action Party candidate is the winner. According to the official Cuban news agency, Cuba's justice minister is asking a special military court to hand down death sentences in 7 of the 14 former officials now convicted on drug trafficking and other charges. This is National Public Radio News in Washington. I'm Frank Stacio.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. The 1967 Monterey Pop Festival was the first big outdoor epic rock festival. The concert was the predecessor of Woodstock, and the film Monterey Pop set the tone for subsequent concert films. Monterey Pop is one of the many films directed by my guest Don Pennebaker. Along with Robert Drew, Richard Laycock, and the Maisels brothers, he created the documentary form known as cinema verite, or direct cinema. These were documentary films that used no scripting, no narration, and no staged scenes. The filmmakers tried to have no effect on their subjects other than to record their actions. Pennebaker worked on groundbreaking films, using this form to examine the primary race between John Kennedy and Hubert Humphrey, and the confrontation over school desegregation between the Kennedy administration and Governor George Wallace. But Pennebaker is best known for his music documentaries, which include Don't Look Back, a film about Bob Dylan's first tour of England, and Bowie, about David Bowie's final concert in his Ziggy Stardust character. Pennebaker has a new film about the British electropop band Depeche Mode. Next week, two of Pennebaker's new films will open in New York at the Film Forum. Jimmy Plays Monterey and Shake are concert films featuring previously unreleased footage of Jimi Hendrix and Otis Redding at the Monterey Pop Festival. I asked Pennebaker why he wanted to produce this footage into new films.
It wasn't a very heavy decision. We've had that stuff sitting there along with somewhere over 1 million feet of stuff that that I've been filming and other people with me have been filming over the last 25 years. And some of it are films we've never even edited or tried to release. There was just no particular demand for them. So it sits there kind of accusingly. And in the case of the Jimmy stuff, Alan Douglas, who represents the Hendrix estate for his father and whoever else is involved, I don't know, came to us and said, listen, you're sitting on all this stuff. It's the best stuff of Jimmy playing, and it's crazy to have it just sit there. Would you make a film? And I said, well, we'd like to, but it's kind of expensive. So he said, well, I'll put up the money if you make the film, and then we'll split it. So we did that, and in the course of doing it, we got into the Otis Redding and made a short of that, eventually expanding that for an HBO show. And then that kind of led us into the Yoko, the John and Yoko piece at Toronto, which we also did for HBO.
Mm-hmm.
All of them eventually, of course, they're all going into video. That's our plan, is to, I've got something like 30 or 40 films that I want to get into video form in the next year or two and get some kind of a library together, because that's the main way to distribute, I think, in the coming generation.
The meaning of the footage that you're using in these new films has really changed, in the sense that Jimi Hendrix is dead, Otis Redding is dead, John Lennon is dead. And so this stuff not only has important archival value, but it's become very important footage because it's some of the best footage that we have of these performers that's ever been recorded. What kind of lesson does that offer to you about the importance of shooting people in action in their time?
Well, it's something I must say I've always absolutely known, but it's really hard to get anyone in a responsible position to deal with it seriously at any level, either in the television itself, on the part of management of whoever it is that you're filming, and sometimes even the performers. I wanted to do a film on Chris Everett so badly for years. And I went to her agent, and she thought about it and finally said, no, I just wish I were filming today. because she's really an interesting person. I think she's the most interesting person in tennis, but that doesn't mean that I'm going to be able to make a film about her, so it's frustrating.
When you look back at how you shot the Monterey Pop film, what do you think you'd do differently now from then?
Not much. I'd probably do it the same way, no directing. I'd get people that I really liked, and I'd let them go their own way. I mean, whose work I liked and who I knew were filmmakers, and let them figure it out themselves. I think that's the strongest way you can film. And in fact, when we were doing the Depeche Mode film, we operated just almost exactly the same as at Monterey.
Mm-hmm. When you say no directing, do you think that many music documentaries have directing in it? Concert films.
Yeah, I think... Well, what you're dealing with is a concept of management. It's like, in a sense, management had a hard time with film because in the end, there was one eye behind the camera, and that was usually, if not an artist, somebody that looked like one. And in the end, you had to depend on what he saw and did. He pulled the trigger. I'm not saying that the cameraman necessarily is the camera operator, but somewhere down the line there's a camera operator that everybody has to trust and go along with. It's hard to look over his shoulder. Now you have video assists. Now there's 26 people in a booth watching every move he makes. He doesn't count for much anymore. I mean, he could be replaced with some kind of a robot. And I think television in general picked up that concept. And it's why television appeals to management more than filmmaking, because, in a sense, the guy in the booth is always management.
Where were you during Monterey Pop? Were you behind one of the cameras?
I was on stage most of the time, partly because Bob Neuwirth, who kind of represented our stage direction, if there was such a thing, that is, he had a red light that he could turn on and off. And the red light meant that when the red light was on, all the filmmakers were encouraged to film if they had film in their cameras or could see anything. It didn't mean they necessarily had to, and in fact, if it weren't on, they could still shoot. There were no rules that strongly. But when someone like Hendrix or Otis came on, even though our general strategy was to shoot one song of each performer, because there were so many performers and we would have run out of film somewhere early in the game if we just shot our whims away. But that each performer, when he came up, Bob would kind of decide which song, and I would sort of be there to kind of just to hear myself what we were doing. I would pretty much let him be the judge of what to do. But in somebody like the minute Hendrix started to play, we were all... I mean, I was somewhat bemused because Hendrix walked out on stage chewing gum, it looked like he was chewing gum, and totally disconnected. And it did not seem to me, I mean, I didn't know much about him. I'd heard that he set himself on fire, which didn't seem to me a very heavy musical aspiration. But we kind of watched, and I think somewhere about 3 seconds into the first song, Neuwirth and I I just looked over there, and the red light was on, and it never went off. And in a way, that's as much directing as I guess I ever did, was to just to be where I knew certain decisions would be made. And then I filmed from that. I could film audience from the stage, and I can film performers.
I want to talk with you about more of your films, but first we're going to take a short break. Don Pennebaker is my guest, and we'll talk more about some of his movies after we take this break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest Don Pennebaker is one of the founders of the documentary style that became known as cinema verite or direct cinema. His best-known movies include Monterey Pop and Don't Look Back, which is about Bob Dylan's first British tour in 1965. Two of his films will have their premiere July 12th at the Film Forum in New York. Let's talk a little bit about Don't Look Back, your movie about Bob Dylan, about his British tour in 1965. Now, I believe that you did this film because Albert Grossman, who was Dylan's manager at the time,
suggested that you accompany them on the tour and shoot the movie. What kind of agreement, if any, did you have about what you'd be allowed to shoot and what would remain off camera?
There was no agreement or arrangement. It was really just a handshake. And I think that that's fair enough. I think that although there was nothing on paper, I think there was a kind of conceptual, I don't know, it's like a gravitational rule that held, and that I could do almost anything I wanted, but I had to be prepared that if in some way I did something, and I'm not sure what it would have been, that in fact was really lame or that didn't appeal to everyone, that the entire thing could collapse instantly. In other words, I was there under a kind of peculiar rule that was only understood, but it was never actually laid out. And I think to this day, neither Dylan and I have any idea what it really consisted of. But it was a real kind of force that controlled what we both did.
Well, it's a fascinating film to look at, especially from the vantage point of over 20 years later. And one of the things that's so interesting is that you see Dylan outside of the performance mode. And he actually comes off as pretty arrogant in a lot of the movie. And I want to play a brief clip from the film.
Okay.
And this is an encounter that he had with a reporter from Time magazine. The reporter wanted to do a story on him, and Dylan's explaining that he really has no interest in Time or this reporter.
Are you going to see the concert tonight?
Yes.
Are you going to hear it?
No.
Okay, you hear and see it, and it's going to happen fast, and you're not going to get it all, and you might even hear the wrong words, you know? And then afterwards, see, I won't be able to talk to you afterwards. I got nothing to say about these things I write. I mean, I just write them. I don't have anything to say anything about them. I don't write them for any reason. There's no great message. I mean, if you know, you want to tell other people that, go ahead and tell them. But I'm not going to have to answer to it. And they're just going to think, you know, what's this Time magazine telling us? But you couldn't care less about that either. You don't know the people that read you. Because, you know, I've never been in Time magazine, and yet this hall is filled twice. You know, and I've never been in Time magazine. I don't need Time magazine. And I don't think I'm a folk singer. You'll probably call me a folk singer. But, you know, the other people know better. Because the people that, you know, that buy my records listen to me don't necessarily read Time magazine.
Well, that's Bob Dylan talking to the reporter from Time. Now, he might be very right about how the Time magazine reporter would have totally misinterpreted what was happening. But he treats him with real contempt in that scene that we were hearing. Did he ever regret, do you think, being captured in that way on camera?
Well, I don't know. Dylan's very mercurial. What he feels in the morning, he may well not feel by the afternoon. And I know that there's some things in that movie because he's been after me for years to take them out. That's not one of them. You see him as being overbearing and, in a sense, making use of his peremptorial position to put down the Time writer, whom I knew. But in the end, he kind of laid back off him in a way that I thought was very... I think he took the curse out of the thing, and I think that the reporter felt that. It was a strange... It's a way that Dylan had of coming down and being extremely abusive, and then just almost as if by comparison of pulling back, and the person felt like it was really not aimed at him. It was aimed at something else and had missed him. And felt kind of a sense of relief. And I think that that's... I know because I read his story that he filed. I have a copy of it, in fact. And it has absolutely in it no vindictiveness toward Dylan.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask which scenes Dylan wanted to take out of the film?
The haranguing in the hotel room with everybody screaming and yelling. And the about the glass being thrown out the window. And it's just because he hated the idea of being seen in that kind of a situation, I guess. I don't know. See, I don't think he had the slightest idea of how that film would look when we began. And what he wanted to do, in a way, he hoped to get something out of it too. He wanted to find out if you could make a movie by yourself, because that's the way he did music, that's the way he did everything. And he didn't want to go to Warner Brothers and be cast in the Bob Dylan film the way Elvis had. So he was looking at to see if there was some other option. And I'm not sure, you know, that that's the movie he would have made. But in the end, he recognized that it was a movie. He was enough of a dramatist, enough of a whatever it is to that looks at movies, to see that it did work, that it would catch an audience interest, and it was about him in some way. But it's the same time he felt ripped off, as you would, or anyone would, in that his life had sort of been used without his total permission. But that's what's required. That's why it's hard to make. So I don't, you know, again, I'm not trying to explain anything. I feel in the movie all I can do is to sit in a corner of the room and show you what it would be like if you were sitting in the corner of the room. And I don't really have much advantage over you. I don't know anything you don't know.
Filmmaker Don Pennebaker is my guest, and his movies include Monterey Pop and Don't Look Back, which is a documentary about Bob Dylan. You have a new film now about Depeche Mode, which is a British electro-pop band. I wonder what it was like for you to do that movie, in the sense that I don't know how much they mean to you, in the same way that some of the performers at Monterey Pop or Bob Dylan might have meant something to you.
You mean, and now after the film or before the film?
Well, before the film, when you decided to take it on. Their following is mostly teenagers, which you're not anymore.
Well, I don't have to be a critic, see. That's the advantage of being a filmmaker. I mean, there's some things you have to be, but I don't have to know what the best music is and, in a sense, present it. I'm not a presenter either. I'm following my nose, and I'm trying to find where a film might be, where something interesting is going on. And I guess something told me that they were ripe for it, and I don't know what it is, and I may never know. But in the end, I know that I did the right thing, because it was such a fantastic thing to do. And we all felt that. It was the most marvelous adventure, and I have the most total respect for those guys, even though you're right, they're a world away from me. We practically can't speak across that generation void. But at the same time, they're fearless. And I really love anybody that's fearless. They go at their concerts the way we go at our filming, and they don't give a damn how we do it. If we want to get out there with handheld cameras walking around the stage, that's our business. And they had no eyes to change that. And I felt that that was terrific, that very few people would give us that reckless abandonment, as it were.
One of the documentary filmmakers you started working with was Robert Drew, and he once said that he wanted to find a new form of documentary because he found himself watching documentaries on TV, subjects that he thought he should be interested in, that he was interested in, and he'd fall asleep. And he figured something's wrong with the way documentaries were being shot. This was in the early 1960s. What were your reasons for wanting to find new ways of making documentary films?
Well, I would like the film to be like the novel, a work of one person's imagination, with whatever help he needs and can get, but not the work of a company whose business is investment.
But as far as the form, what did you think needed fixing?
Well, I think it was too dead. It's like the lighting in most Hollywood films. It all looks like the magazine stories in Architectural Digest, where nobody lives in the rooms. There's no throw up on the floor. There's no baby pissing in a corner. It's all kind of a dead world, and I think movies reflect that, and it's a fake world. It has no grain in it. It has no life in it.
When you first started making documentaries, it was essential to have camera equipment that made it possible to follow people around and to be as unintrusive as possible. I think you contributed a lot to redesigning camera equipment to make it more portable.
Well, we had to. In World War II, which was supposedly the war about which all the movies were being made, the only cameras were 35-millimeter hand-wound cameras that would run about 18 seconds, the IMOs, the Bell and Hall IMO. And that meant that in the end, almost all the films that you'll ever see about World War II are fake films. Any cannon is looks like the cannon you need. Any bomb bursting is the bomb you need. So in a way, it's put together like Hollywood movies are. There's very little continuity of reality, except for one film, which was made on a carrier. And that they made with 16mm. They were able to use long runs, 400-foot rolls, so they could have 10-minute runs. And while it has no sound, it has the realest feeling you ever saw in a movie of that period, and it stuns you. And it hit me when I saw that film that that's the way real life could be recorded, with long runs. But you had to get out of the studio. You had to get away from things to plug in. You had to find ways of getting sync sound in a desert or in an opera or any place interchangeably. You couldn't have a special solution for each movie. You had to have a general solution for anything you decided to do that morning.
So you designed what to make this
well,
more possible?
We designed a camera that you could hold on your shoulder and only ran, mine eventually ran less than 2 or 3 watts to run. It's still less than most cameras that you can buy. And you could look through it, you could turn it on, it would lock into sync. So when you played it back, it would play back in real time. And we did work on many aspects, lights, the Nagras. We worked with Kedelsky on the Nagra to develop something that was also portable. I think in the beginning, we put clocks on everything. We had clock cameras and clock recorders because we were using the Bulova Accutron watch, which was fairly accurate. And by using that to trigger the motor in the camera and the motor on the tape, or record a single tape, we were able to lock them together and make them sync up.
We only have about a minute left, so I'll ask you this quickly. There must be a moment in your career when you think back and think to yourself, why wasn't the camera running when that happened?
No, because if you get that way, you can get suicidal. Because you keep wanting to have people go back and come through the door again or do something or say something that just seemed to you fantastic. And you just learned to not listen to that voice, to let it happen, because sooner or later what you know is that people will do everything over and over again. They always do it over and over again. And they know what they're doing. They're watching you. They're watching you as much as you're watching them. And they want you to get their lives. They really want you to do it. It worked with Kennedy that way. It's worked with... I mean, Kennedy had to sneak us in the back of the White House because he wanted us to make that film. And it happens over and over again. So you begin to not worry about that. That's the wrong thing to worry about. You worry about... I don't know what you worry about. Everything you worry about whether you have enough film and you're going to get it processed, but you don't worry about what you don't get, because in the end you know you're going to miss 90% anyhow. I mean, movies are made with 10% of what happened, but that's better than no percent, which is what generally people get.
Okay, well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about your movies.
Okay.
Documentary filmmaker Don Pennebaker has been my guest. One of his best-known films is Monterey Pop, and he has two new films edited from footage shot for Monterey Pop. Those films, featuring Otis Redding and Jimi Hendrix, will debut July 12th at the Film Forum in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, veteran TV journalist David Brinkley. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, writer, actor, and director Paul Bartel. He got his start making movies heavy on the sex and violence for Roger Corman. Bartel went on to make his own comedy of sex and violence, Eating Raoul, about a super square couple who kill wealthy swingers in order to reduce the number of perverts. Bartel's new film, Scenes from the Class Struggle in Beverly Hills, is a sex farce starring Jacqueline Bisset, Ed Begley Jr., and Wallace Shawn. And now that it's summer, the festivals are upon us. Food festivals, music festivals, arts and crafts festivals. Commentator Maureen Corrigan tells us why she's given up on them. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, this is Bill Redlin. Oliver North will spend no time in prison, but he will pay $150,000 in fines and do community service as his punishment for convictions in the Iran-Contra affair. Judge Gerhard Gesell pronounced sentence this morning. This afternoon, NPR spoke with people in Washington to get their reaction to the punishment for the former White House aide and retired Marine.
I think the dollar fine is okay. Personally, I thought he should have spent some time in jail.
I didn't think he belonged in jail. And I think that this is an excellent decision by Judge Gesell. I'm very happy to hear this.
All those people involved should have gotten some time, if you really want to know my opinion. I think that this $150,000 fine, you know, I'm pretty sure he can come up with that money. That's really not going to hurt him that much.
The Navy has suspended North's annual military pension, and it is asking the Comptroller General to determine whether the pay should be revoked permanently. President Bush would not comment, and the White House said it has decided it was inappropriate to say anything at this time since North can appeal his convictions. Florida Governor Bob Martinez today announced his intention to make Florida one of the first states to re-regulate abortion in the wake of the recent Supreme Court decision. More from Rick Stone in Miami.
Martinez must still decide whether to present the issue during the October special session or at a special session sometime before then. Although no specifics have been announced, Martinez said he intends to balance the rights of pregnant women against those of unborn babies while favoring the babies.
Under the old decision, we may have been as strict as we could be, but there's a new decision now, and that opens up, I believe, greater rights for the unborn, and therefore it ought to be exercised.
The governor predicted that the decision in the Supreme Court's Webster case would legitimize Florida's controversial parental consent abortion law that's now before the state Supreme Court. Martinez said it's unlikely that the legislature will ignore any opportunity for regulation that the Webster case presents. For National Public Radio, this is Rick Stone in Miami.
A decision on whether gambling allegations against baseball's Pete Rose should be heard in federal court or in a local Cincinnati court has been postponed for 2 weeks. The delay is a temporary setback for Rose, who had asked through his lawyers that the case be sent back to the local court, which has already ruled once in Rose's favor. The Cincinnati Reds manager is seeking a long-term order to block baseball commissioner Bart Giamatti from holding a disciplinary hearing into charges Rose gambled on baseball games, including ones that involved his own team. The former player and superstar contends Giamatti has prejudged the issue, and he wants someone else to decide the matter. The leaders of the Soviet Union and France today called for a ceasefire in Lebanon's 14-year-old civil war, that from Mikhail Gorbachev and François Mitterrand, who are meeting in France. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. No one with a decent respect for bad taste will want to miss Paul Bartel's new movie, wrote film critic Stuart Kluwans. Bartel co-writes, directs, and stars in his comedies. His 1982 comedy of bad taste, Eating Raoul, became a cult classic. Bartel got his start in Hollywood making action films for the king of B-movies, Roger Corman. He directed Cannonball and Death Race 2000, a futuristic thriller about a car race in which drivers get extra points for running down pedestrians. Bartel's new film is a sex farce called Scenes from the Class Struggle in Beverly Hills. It takes place over a weekend at the lavish Beverly Hills mansion of a washed-up TV actress trying for a comeback, played by Jacqueline Bisset. The cast of characters include a quack doctor, a pretentious playwright, a social-climbing gold digger, two ethnic servants, and a neglected housewife. I asked Bartel if the film is about people he knew.
It's about people that I know, people that I've read about, and people that I'd like to know.
I feel like this demands an explanation.
All of the incidents in the script are either things that Bruce Wagner, my writer friend and collaborator, and I have actually witnessed or have read about or have been told about confidentially by reliable sources.
Well, there are certain character types that you parody in the movie. Let's look at your role, for instance. You play Dr. Mo Vandekamp, a thinologist. is this a type you know from real life or from TV talk shows? Tell us about the character.
Well, the doctor is a quack, and God knows Beverly Hills has plenty of them. Actually, my role was originally supposed to be the dog's psychiatrist, but Paul Mazursky used that joke in Down and Out in Beverly Hills, so we had to revise our script. And Bruce, I think taking cruel advantage of my problems in keeping my weight down, decided to write me as a thinologist, and I went along with the joke.
Everyone, this is Kelly. She did a piece on me for Lifestyle magazine.
Oh, I adore Lifestyle.
Oh, good. Do tell me about the article. Is it going to be whatever happened to Hillary?
Mm-hmm. What are all these black flecks everywhere?
They're ashes from the fire.
There's supposedly 17 separate fires going.
17?
Spread over two or three counties.
The winds are fanning it.
No wonder I couldn't sleep.
The winds breed depression. I recommend junk food until you're ready to vomit. Then a bracing saltwater enema.
The tastelessness in your movies is rude but not revolting, if you know what I mean. It never gets like terribly explicit or graphic. Can you talk about the kinds of tastelessness that interest you most?
Well, I would never refer to the things that I do as tasteless. I think taste is a spectrum. And actually what I try to accomplish is a kind of contradiction. I try to take subject matter that is likely to offend or upset people in the abstract and treat it as tactfully and as discreetly as possible so that they are induced to laugh at it at the same time that they're gasping.
What are the things that you really have to work at getting right in terms of tone and timing to achieve that effect?
Well, of course, the principal thing in a motion picture is the visual image. And even while people are preparing to do shocking things, I try to keep the image as discreet as possible so that in the scene, for instance, towards the end of the film, where the two servants are finally consummating their bet, and one of them is about to have sexual congress with the other. I carry on the shot of the back rub, which terminates in the withdrawal of the underpants, right up to the point where I think the audience is going to think, oh my God, he's not really going to make us watch this, is he? And then I cut away.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your movies, usually play people who are refined and inhibited on the surface, but kind of perverse underneath. And I was wondering if you see an element of that in yourself, or what it is in yourself or in your acting that leads you to write characters like that for you to play.
I find it very unproductive to be too analytical about my own persona and the parts that I play. I follow my instincts. If it makes me laugh when I see it on the screen, then I'm satisfied.
I'm going to persist, though, and ask you if you think of yourself as looking different from what you're really like.
Well, nobody, no, I shouldn't say nobody, but most people, have a different concept of themselves than other people have of them. But I can certainly tell you that the character of Mo Vandekamp is very different from the way I am in real life. I certainly don't speak in the kind of aphorisms that he does, and I'm not nearly as pompous as he is. And I hope that I'm not a charlatan, which he certainly is.
You left out one thing. Are you a lecher?
No.
Okay.
No, I'm not a lecher. And that certainly is one of his primary characteristics.
<You're>
right.
My guest is director, screenwriter, and actor Paul Bartel. His movies include Eating Raoul and the new movie Scenes from the Class Struggle in Beverly Hills. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Paul Bartel is my guest. Now, you got your start in movies, or at least one of the things that helped you get started in movies was working for Roger Corman. Now, for him, you directed exploitation movies, action movies. Now, does that fit in with your image of yourself at all?
No. In fact, the element that I contributed to the most successful of the films that I made for Roger, which was Death Race 2000, was black humor. I'm afraid that that the action in that film, while there were some nice action sequences, was not really, that was all there in the script and in the storyboard, and all I had to do was execute it. So I didn't feel that I could take much, or I don't feel that I can take much credit for that. But it was some of the jokes and some of the comic notions in the film. I think some of the jokes may have gone over Roger Corman's head, and I think he resented a certain amount of the humor that went into it. He kept vacillating between the feeling that he wanted a hard action film and wanting a sophisticated comedy, and he would go back and forth. And I knew what I wanted, and I just stuck to my guns and put as much comedy into it as possible. In my cut of the film, there was no blood at all. He added a lot of crushed heads and splattering blood.
Did you give yourself any cameos in the movies you directed for Corman?
In my very first feature film, which was done for Roger's brother, Gene Corman, I played a silent cameo of a bum that stumbles out from behind a tree in the park. It was about a 5-second appearance, I would say. Mm-hmm. In my second feature, which was Death Race 2000, I gave myself about 5 lines. I played the surgeon who wheels David Carradine in on a gurney, just having been put back together and announcing, I announced to the press that he was ready to race again.
So you never graduated from the Corman Studios to become a big action film director yourself. Instead, you went a completely different route. You ended up writing, producing, and directing your own movies. How did you end up taking that direction?
After Cannonball was released, I went through a period of 5 years where I worked on projects that never quite made it to the screen. I did appear in a number of films as an actor that did make it to the screen. But during this 5-year period, I was hired to write scripts, to supervise other people writing scripts, which I was supposed eventually to direct. And none of them were fully financed or could be cast to the satisfaction of the studio. All of them fell apart for one reason or another. And towards the end of the 5 years, I really started getting desperate. I knew I wanted to make a film that was very personal, but I also wanted to make something that was commercial, and I thought that if I could come up with a funny idea that was based on the elements of sex and violence, which were the two cornerstones of the Corman empire, that I could probably get Roger to back the project. So together with my friend Dick Blackburn, I hatched the idea for Eating Raoul. At first, we had discussed writing a film in which Mary and I would play detectives. Then we decided that that was probably a cliched idea that had already been overexposed on television. And instead of detectives, we went to the opposite extreme and made ourselves murderers.
So the premise of the story was that you and Mary Warrenoff play a put-upon middle-class couple who decide to lure swingers to your apartment through ads in the sex magazines, and then you rob and kill them.
Right. And in order to get the money for our little country kitchen.
Right.
The idea in a single line is that we play a couple that are so upset with the with Los Angeles, with that in order to get away from the violence and sexuality of life in Los Angeles, we become we embark on a career of sex murders.
Right. In order to get away from all the filth.
Right.
Do you realize that we have made almost $1,000 in 2 days, tax-free?
Just by killing people.
Horrible sex-crazed maniacs that nobody in the world would miss. I wonder how much we could make if we really put our minds to it.
What do you mean?
The city is full of rich perverts. If somehow we could get them to come to the apartment...
But Barry, why would they? We'd have to lure them with...
sex.
But you wouldn't really have to, I mean, you wouldn't actually do anything.
Of course not. The minute they try anything dirty, you pop them in the head and get rid of them like you did with this guy.
But Mary, how would we contact them? We don't know anything about this swinger business.
Ask someone who does.
All of them read this?
Isn't there something a little more
classier? Nope, this paper covers the field from the richest to the poorest. If they're kinky, they read the Hollywood Press.
This scenario provides great opportunities for showing the absurdity, for mocking S&M costumes and S&M theater. I think you have a really good time with that.
Yes, all of the little sex fetishes that people seem to become so attached to in this town, the Nazi fetish, the leather and chain fetish, the... and even some that we invented, the little boy fetish, the we took a very sort of cloddish middle class approach to all these fetishes, and somehow the synthesis of that that point of view for our characters and the sophistication of what they were trying to do resulted in laughs.
When you were writing or directing this movie, did you go to any sex clubs or sex shops to get in the spirit for the movie?
Well, we went to some sex stores, and we looked at some sex papers because there was a whole plot element that involved putting running an ad in one of the Los Angeles sex papers. Unfortunately, our budget was so low, we didn't have enough money to be able to afford to print prop paper. So we went to one of the real sex papers and we offered to mention their name several times in the film, and in exchange we asked them to run our ad 1 week in their paper. And we got some very curious answers to our ads, mostly from German people.
What kind of responses?
There was one fellow who wanted very much to meet Cruel Carla and felt that he might actually have met her once before. He thought he recognized her from the paper, and he hoped that if indeed she was the woman that he'd met in the past, that she would remember his specialty and still be willing to engage in it.
You and your wife star in your movies.
Well, she's not my wife.
She's not your wife?
No,
oh,
she's
I'm
just
sorry.
A good friend.
Oh.
She's only my wife in the movies.
Gosh, I really thought you were married.
No.
That means you're not lovers either?
No, I'm gay, and she's a painter.
Gosh, that's really funny. I thought you were a couple.
Well, we are a couple, but
a different
we're
kind
not
of couple,
that kind
right.
of a couple.
So I won't ask you about what it's like to direct her having affairs with Robert Beltran in movies.
No, you should ask me if I'd had an affair with Robert Beltran.
That's right. Well, did you?
Well, I wish I could say I had, but I haven't. He's wonderful, though. I wish I could make him a star. I wish that this movie would catapult him up there to the place where the studios would take a serious interest in him. He and Arneesha Walker are the two people that I really, mm-hmm. above all else, wish that this film would help.
Well, you and have I'm such a great cast in the new movie. You've got the people you just mentioned. You have Wallace Shawn. Paul Mazursky has a cameo. Ed Begley Jr. is in it. Is Jacqueline Bisset. Yourself, Mary Warrenoff. Ray Sharkey? It's a terrific group of people. I was wondering, are they mostly friends of yours? Or these are really interesting actors who don't always get great parts in movies.
They are. Ray Sharkey I had known slightly over the years, but never become a close friend of. Wally Shawn I was a fairly good friend of, and I actually didn't want him in the movie. I didn't think he was right for the part. But when Wally read, and he read not only the part that he played, the gynecologist, but he also read the playwright, he was so funny and so unexpected and so original and interesting that the question became not should we cast him, but which role should we give him. We finally decided it was a cheap shot to cast him as the playwright. So he played the gynecologist, and I think he's one of the main pillars of the movie.
Mm-hmm. I have never been able to figure out how you can direct yourself in a movie. I mean, how a director can also star in the film. You managed to do that. Well, can you give me a sense of what the tricks are to making that work?
It's the same way that Dumbo is able to fly. If you believe you can do it, you can.
All right, I'll accept that as a highly analytical answer.
Well, as I was saying before, you know, I was telling you that I started out doing a silent bit in my first picture, and then I did five lines in my second, and I built up. Each picture I've given myself a larger role until in Eating Raoul I thought, what the hell, I'm risking my own money. This is all being done by me and my friends. Why shouldn't Mary and I play the leads? And we did, and it worked out.
As an independent director and actor and writer, I think you've stayed so far, in a way, on the periphery of the commercial film industry, as opposed to right in the middle, right in the mainstream of it. Is it your intention to stay there, or are you trying to work your way into the center?
I have nothing against the commercial film industry, and I have often been involved with commercial, you know, big studio films as an actor. And a lot of my friends have directed them, and I would be happy to direct a film for a big studio. I did, in fact, direct a film for Orion a couple of years back, a Tim Conway comedy called The Long Shot. But about 10 years ago, I sort of had a talk with myself and decided that rather than try to become a commercial director, one of the directors that studios hire to do the big commercial projects that they develop, that I would much prefer being an independent producer, director, with my own, you know, sort of specialized style, somewhat limited audience, but more intense identity. I would prefer to be an artist, to whatever degree I have the right to claim that identity, than a maker of commercial products.
Paul Bartel directed and stars in the new comedy Scenes from the Class Struggle in Beverly Hills. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Noah Adams. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. On our program, NPR's Deborah Amos has a report from Guangzhou, China, a city that has greatly benefited from Chinese economic reforms over the past 10 years or so, reforms that are now, of course, being called into question. Also, Robert Siegel will talk with some Chinese students in this country about where they see the democracy movement going. They are taking a rather long view of history at the moment. We'll talk with the postmaster in Lynn, Massachusetts, about police escorts being used to ensure the safety of the mail carriers on one street there. Also, commentator Daniel Pinkwater begins a five-part series that you could call of cats and women.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The 4th of July parties and parades are over, but it's the height of the season for summer festivals. That's good news for some people, but not for commentator Maureen Corrigan.
The worst part of summer in the city isn't the heat, garbage, noise, or crowds, but those summer festivals that jam heat, garbage, noise, and crowds into three fun-filled square blocks. I hate them. So far this summer, I've detoured my way around a polka marathon, a crafts festival in New York's Lincoln Center that featured square dancing and live sheep shearing, a celebration of the summer solstice, Lebanese, Ukrainian, African, Gaelic, and Japanese folk festivals, and all 5 days of the 4th of July Philadelphia Freedom Festival. Every time I step out of my apartment these days, I'm in the middle of another festival. A few Sundays ago, I walked over to the art museum. It's free, cool, and quiet, and if you can't afford a vacation at the beach, you can at least go to the museum and stare at paintings of the ocean. not that Sunday, a merry old Renaissance fair was in full swing. There it was, the entire glorious three-century history of the Renaissance, encapsulated by seven actors in Halloween drag. They jousted and wrestled with each other and bounded through the galleries shouting, "Huzzah, wench, and God save the queen!" The little kids loved it, but I wished for a return of the Dark Ages. Last month, my friend Amy, who likes these things, strong-armed me into going to something called a jambalaya jam, a celebration for no discernible reason of New Orleans music and Cajun cooking. It looked an awful lot like the Renaissance to me. Mobs of people jousting and wrestling with each other, out-of-work actors, this time selling crawfish keychains. "I'm going home," I told Amy. "I hate summer festivals." "You're not with the people on this one," she warned me, hoping to prick my populist conscience. But I kept moving. It's not that I don't share some of the same yearnings that lead people to seek out festivals on beautiful summer afternoons. I, too, emerge in May from my winter world of isolated TV watching, wanting to connect with other people, to have authentic experiences. But giant summer festivals always wind up making me feel more alienated. I'm suspicious that what we're really celebrating, apart from the flimsy ethnic and historical trappings of these festivals, is our common identity as consumers, and that the only authentic experience they offer is that of shopping. But other people disagree. Festival fiends like Amy just hang loose and enjoy. And some liberal ethnographers and urban planners interpret summer festivals as a sign of a renewed sense of community among city dwellers. Right. Maybe they should try wandering around, ankle-deep in beer and cheese fries, along with 6,000 other people wearing foam moosehead antlers, all celebrating Canada Day. Is this an affirmation of civic solidarity or an urban hell? I know what I think.
Maureen Corrigan keeps an eye on social patterns for Fresh Air and contributes book reviews to The Village Voice. We're listening to The Brave Combo playing the clarinet polka. Fresh Air's research interns are Hilary Goldhammer, Liz Trubert, and Christopher Cook. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet television journalist David Brinkley. Also, feminist mystery writer Barbara Wilson joins us. Her new novel, The Dog Collar Murders, offers a humorous look at the debates between the S&M and anti-pornography factions in the lesbian feminist community. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.